The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
What's up, bingers? My guest today is an award-winning investigative journalist and best-selling author. He has appeared in a lot of true crime shows that you've probably seen and even consulted on the Showtime series Dexter. He is the host of the new Crossing the Line podcast. Please welcome M. William Phelps. The internet's full of true crime podcasts. More and more are added to the list every day. Figuring out where to start or where to go next can be overwhelming. But have no fear, I'm here to help. I'm Bob Ruff, and this is the place to find your next true crime binge. All right, I'm joined by M. William Phelps. A lot of you may be familiar with his work. He's been on a ton of true crime documentaries. And thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me. I'm really enjoying the new podcast.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to meet you. Call me Matthew, please. That's what the M is for, Matthew.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was going to ask you, I wasn't sure if I call you M the whole time, like a James Bond movie.
Lots of people call me Michael. And I'm like, no, I don't have any gold medals.
Michael Phelps, the swimmer. Well, I was going to ask you, like, who did it first? Was it you or Shyamalan that started going with the M?
I did. I did it 20-something years ago.
So yeah, you beat him to the punch.
I think I might have. Yeah, I think okay. I might have.
All right. So first thing, tell me a little bit about. I mean, you have a ton of stuff that you've done. I've seen you before on several. I'm obviously into true crime. That's why I do this on several things on ID and on Oxygen.
Right.
But I didn't realize you're sounds like your true passion is you're an author. You have over 45 books. You're a New York Times bestselling author.
Yeah. I've been writing true crime now for, since the 90s, late 90s, and publishing books since, in early 2000s. And, it's not something that I planned on doing. The day before I became a true crime writer, author, I didn't know I was going to be that. I found a great story close to me, a nurse. Kristen Gilbert was on trial for killing 7 of her patients. So I started covering that case, and that case turned into a book. I investigated it and, found out she killed likely over 100 people. And so that book became Perfect Poison, and next thing I knew, I was a true crime author. I really didn't know there was a genre, true crime. I was just passionate about telling stories about people. That was my passion.
Right. Well, back in the 90s, true crime wasn't as on the nose as it is now, where it's its own it's its own genre now. It wasn't really like that back in the 90s.
It's funny. I've seen it go through this kind of trend, when I started, it was black and red book covers, true crime, and it was looked at as drugstore pulp. Us writers were looked at as tabloidish type of writers.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of peaked a little bit in the 2000s, 2010, somewhere around there. And, what really pissed me off about the genre a lot, Bob, is that someone like James B. Stewart, that's his name. He's a great writer. He wrote for The New Yorker. He wrote for some newspapers, etc. He'll put out a book and they'll call it narrative nonfiction, but it's a true crime book. He's writing about serial murder. So true crime authors were kind of marginalized into this, subsection of what I like to say is my books back then, even today, are in the bookstore on the bottom shelf by the toilet. That's where the true crime section usually is.
Right. Yeah, and Barnes & Noble's in the back corner of the store by the restrooms. Yep.
Yeah. But, you know, I put in a tremendous amount of effort, work, investigation, getting exclusive information from my books, and people can call them whatever they want. I just keep doing the work, you know?
And you originally cut your teeth as an investigative journalist, right, before you started writing books?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about this on an episode of Crossing the Line in the next 8-10 weeks or so. I'm going to dedicate an episode to it. But, you know, in the 90s, I was just writing for newspapers, freelance, covering politics. I covered music for the most part, but I like to write about people. And I heard this guy on the radio, his name is William Acosta, and he was just a mole. He did work for the CIA, FBI. He became a NYPD detective. And everywhere he went, he rooted out corruption. So I gave him a call and I said, you know, I'd like to work on a story about you. That story became, wow, this is a book. And we became close. And, you know, he's been an investigator his entire life. So when I met him, I was a journalist. And he taught me how to be an investigative journalist. He really taught me how to investigate people and crime and et cetera. So, yeah, I was on the beat, Bob.
Yeah. Is that what you went to school for, was journalism?
Bob, I did not graduate high school. I do not have a GED. I never went to college. When I decided I wanted to be a journalist, I took some, you know, non-credited college journalism courses in the summer, and I learned from the pros what to do, what not to do, and then I just ran with it, you know? So writing is a passion. If you're not passionate about writing and about your subject, there's no way that I can get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write. There's just no way I can do it, but
sure,
I'm driven by it.
Yeah, you know, that's super interesting. I mean, it's a whole nother sidebar. My feelings on our education system and what schools,
right?
The pressure schools. You know, I've got four kids. I've got a couple that really
me as well.
Yeah, I got a couple that really excel at school. I've got a couple that really struggle. My oldest is turning 21 in a couple weeks. But like when he was in school, you know, school wasn't his thing. He's very artistic. He's got a lot going on, and you know,
same with me. Same with me. My mind was somewhere else. My mind was on big things, you know, not algebra, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I just hated it. You know, I had my own, as when I was younger, before I had kids and stuff, I had my own preconceived notions about, you know, the conformity that we've been taught our whole lives about, well, if you want to be successful, you got to go to college and this and that. And then,
right.
And then I have a kid who struggles with school. Bright kid, struggles at school. And he was just made to feel less than. He was made to feel like he could never succeed because he wasn't good at geometry. And it's just horrible. Bullshit. So I love hearing stories like yours where it's like, you know, you didn't need all that. You know, and I have a degree in fire science and another one in business administration. I was a fire chief before I did this. And I tell people all the time, all those years of school I did, I learned more about how to be a firefighter in my first week of being a firefighter than I did in years of college.
That was my whole mentality. My mentality was, if I want to be a boxer, the best, I'm going to get in the ring with Mike Tyson and let him whip my ass until
right.
I can whip his ass. Right. So I approached writing that way. Anytime I saw a Pulitzer Prize or a New York Times bestselling author teaching a course or giving a seminar, I jumped at it because I want the information they have. I want what they have, you know? So
right.
You can't learn to write in school. You can learn to, you know, you can learn English, you can learn grammar, you can learn all that, but you can't learn to be a creative writer in school. You just have to do it, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, and my story is similar to all this, you know, somehow I ended up from being a fire chief to being a true crime podcaster. My other show, Truth and Justice, you know, I write a 25-page script every week, and you know, I've got hundreds of thousands of listeners. Like, when the hell did I become a writer? When did that happen?
And so those pieces of paper on your wall are meaningless to what you're doing right now and what you're passionate about.
100% meaningless. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I have one piece of paper on my wall in my office, and it's an award, and I'm not a big award guy, but it's an award from the Connecticut Society of Journalists for investigative journalism, and mm-hmm. that makes me proud that they acknowledged an article I wrote for Connecticut Magazine because I busted my ass on it. And that article actually became the first season of Paper Ghosts, the missing girls.
That was the iHeartRadio program you did, podcast you did, right? Yeah.
Yeah, season one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and I listened to a lot of that. That was super interesting too. But yeah, it's such an interesting, you know, I taught a lot within the fire service, and there was these things that where you had to, you know, jump through all these hoops to get accredited with the state, or because I created my own classes and I traveled around the country and taught, you know, incident command classes and risk management classes. And then, you know, some people say, well, is this accredited by the IFSAC, the national organization? And I would always answer the same thing. I was like, well, this is what you got to ask yourself. Do you want to be certified or qualified? Because I'll teach you how to do it.
That's right.
I can give you a piece of paper that doesn't mean shit. But
that's right.
What you want to do is be qualified. And that's what you did. And I just love those stories. My showrunner for my TV series on Oxygen, very similar, dropped out of high school, dropout. And she's a big showrunner with a ton of huge productions. She just learned on the job how to do her job.
I mean, I've produced a lot, executive produced a lot of true crime, and people I meet, people I hire, same thing, creatives, mm-hmm. you know, they follow their passion, you know, and I encourage my kids to do that. And like you, I have four kids, and one of them is in her final leg of the physician's assistant program. She's smart. She's going to be a PA. The others, you know, one's a restaurant manager, one's a chef, you know, and mm-hmm. My other child is three. So,
but started over, huh?
Not by design, Bob. That's a 10 episode podcast. But no, I have a 33-year-old, a 31-year-old, a 22-year-old, and a 3-year-old. So, yeah.
So right about the time you were getting out of the woods, you're changing diapers again.
Oh God. Yeah. Well, she doesn't live with me. She lives in Utah. I live in Connecticut. I love her. She's beautiful. And like I said, it's a story in and of itself.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So when did you make the leap from, well, you haven't because you're still writing, but you're also now you've broken into the true crime space. You did, you know, we mentioned the Paper Ghost, the iHeartRadio series, and now you've just started this year crossing the line, but you've also done a ton of work in television. When did you make that, again, I keep wanting to call it a leap or a transition, but it's not like you quit doing your other work at the same time, but how did that opportunity present itself to you?
That same book I wrote about the killer nurse, Perfect Poison, I got a call from a production company out of Australia, Beyond Productions, and they were doing a pilot called Poisonous Women for Discovery Channel. Mm-hmm. This is pre-investigation Discovery. And so they came over, they interviewed me, you know, we did some, stand-ups outside, and we went to the scene and all of that stuff. And when they got the producer got the material back in Australia, he called me. He said, listen, he said, you're great. I mean, you have it. Lots of people don't have it. And I'm like, well, I'm just being myself. And he says, I want to work a lot more with you. So Poisonous Women was a three-part series on Discovery. And then a couple years later, Investigation Discovery started. So they turned Poisonous Women into Deadly Women. And they hired me. And I've been on every season. I do like 10 episodes a season. And then that just snowballed for me. It turned into other TV stuff. And then I created a show called Dark Minds. And I brought in Beyond Productions. And we sold it to Investigation Discovery. Did three seasons of that. It was unsolved cold case serial killer show. I had a serial killer on each week. It was kind of like Silence of the Lambs. He was anonymous, and he would give me direction. He would help me with the cases I was looking at. And I did that with John Kelly, a forensic psychologist. So that led to more, you know. And as you know, I'm sure, I quickly learned that you need to produce. You need to be an executive producer of what you're doing in order to, in order to, be involved and make sure it's to the standard you like, and B, to have some ownership of what you create, you know?
I think that's huge. I've got a lot of friends in the podcast space that have stepped into the TV space a little bit. And luckily I had heard enough horror stories. I had two things working in my advantage when I did the Forgotten West Memphis 3 on Oxygen, and that was I had heard enough horror stories to not give up complete creative control over my content, and also I didn't want to be on TV, which put me in a pretty unique negotiating position. So I was like, no, I want veto power over this, and they're like, no way. I'm like, okay, well then fuck off, because I don't really want to do this anyway.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned that, because my passion is writing the television program, producing it, filming it. My least favorite part of it is when it airs, you know. I don't watch it. People today are just horrible. I could be talking about, you know, a girl who's been raped and strangled and thrown in a pond. And her parents end up finding her, you know, and people will attack my hair and my shoes and, you know, and it's like, you know, what's important here, I've learned to just have tough skin, and I've learned not to read reviews at all. Any reviews anymore.
Yeah.
Just
same.
Don't even go there. You know, it's people are horrible out there. You know, or I should say people can be horrible out there, you know, not everyone, obviously, but, you know, social media is just ruthless.
Yeah. That's my advice to all new podcasters when their shows start to get popular, is stop reading the reviews. Just stop. You're going to make yourself nuts. One of our co-hosts, Zach, on Truth and Justice on our Friday follow-up, he read the very first review. He read a bunch of reviews when he first joined the show. And he still, to this day, anytime somebody says anything bad, he goes, well, I guess I'm just a stupid bag of doorknobs anyway, because that was the first Apple review that he read.
That's the creative guy, because the creative guy gets 1,000 five-star reviews, but only focuses on the one, one-star attack. And here's the reality I've learned about podcast reviews. Here's the reality. You know, millions of listeners, subscribers, 100 bad reviews or attacks are meaningless. It's like 0.00001% of what you're doing, you know? So I just can't read any of them, you know? On my own social media, my Instagram and my Twitter and my Facebook, you know, people will come on and oh, yeah, I love what you do. It's great. And thank you very much. I appreciate that. I really do. I really genuinely appreciate, you know, you liking it, you know, because it, you know, there's so much work goes into a podcast. I mean,
right. People a lot of times think that because they heard a 35-minute episode that you spent 35 minutes making the episode. And they don't know. It took five people 60 hours this week to make that 35 minutes.
Exactly. So, you know, and it took another, you know, 20 hours of writing, you know, and editing and research and, you know, so, yeah, you know, and Actually, getting into the podcast world for me was an interesting story because, you know, I had the books I had been writing. I'd been doing TV, executive producing. So I had those two things going in the true crime space. And a couple of companies approached me about a podcast, and I did. I felt icky. I was like, yeah, I'm not ready to jump in that space yet. And then iHeart, I had a meeting with them, and I just loved what they had to say to me, and I jumped right in. And I took everything I learned from book writing and TV producing and all of that, and just put it into this, you know. And I really love the format. I really do. It's perfect for me.
There's a lot of freedom in podcasting, and you're not limited to. You know, I kind of went the other way. I was in podcasting and then into TV, and that was a struggle for me trying to, you know, when everything now has to fit into, you know, with Oxygen, the show had to be a six-act structure in an hour, and you had this many minutes, and then, the, you know, it's like this, everything had to be in these, like, tight little windows, and it was really difficult for me on the creative
control
side.
And control, and the network control of it all, you know? I mean, okay, I get it. I get, you know, they have a certain thing they need for their viewers. I get that, but it is hard. It is hard to do. Yes. Very frustrating.
So one of the things I see in your bio that really caught my attention was, I read that you consulted on the Showtime series Dexter, which is like one of my all-time favorite shows. Like, tell me about that. How'd that happen, and what was your role?
I got a call before the first episode of the entire show even aired, about 6 months or so before. And I got a call if I could, and I had to do this quick, if I could turn around what they wanted to do is create a contest, a website and a live contest where in the back of semi tractor trailer trucks, glassed in, create a crime scene. With a real serial killer, Son of Sam, you know, whatever, Bundy, create a scene and have people guess who the killer is. And then your name goes into a hat, if you will, for a car, but with Dexter advertising over the whole thing.
Right.
Right. So I called him back and I had a meeting and I said, listen, I said, you can't do that. You can't put real victims in the back of a semi truck. That's insensitive. And you're going to get sued. Mm-hmm. I said, why not just make it a crime scene and have Dexter the killer? That's good advertising, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I created all that, and then I created some crime scenes for them. And I had to do it real quick. So I had to read the book, read all the materials, get all the character studies. And I literally was up for like 48 hours doing this. And then another 2 days of putting it all together. It was intense. It was fun. And, you know, it's a good credential. I mean, I worked on it on the show before it even aired, which I loved.
Now, did you, I'm assuming you're not still working on that project.
No, absolutely not. That show took off in a direction, you know? And it was a great show. I know Jeff Lindsay. I know him, and he's very happy with it all, obviously. Why wouldn't he be? I didn't. I've been called to consult on movies for TV, crime movies, you know. So I've done a little bit of that, which is... It's fun and it's exciting, but it's ultimately frustrating. Mm-hmm. I was asked to consult. One thing that's interesting is I consulted on Piers Morgan had a show called Killer Women, and then a show called Serial Killer, and they called me to be his consultant on that. So I literally hooked him up with some serial killers that I had been kind of corresponding with for years, so he could interview them. And I traveled with him to talk to him about how to interview serial killers, you know. Of course,
right.
Hardly none of my advice was taken. They, you know, I kind of feel like they just wanted my name on it for some reason. You know, he's a great guy. I mean, despite his brand, he's a really nice guy. The production company was great. And I really enjoyed that on the ground, where the crimes took place, talking, consulting with someone who's going to go in and interview a serial killer and tell, you know, so I had brought my expertise to that, which, you know, interviewing a serial killer is a, it's a dance. You have to know what you're doing. You cannot be off your game for 1 second. And so it's an art, really. And I've really mastered the art of that, to my own mental psychological detriment, really.
So when you started this this podcast, Crossing the Line, it's another iHeartRadio production. How did that come to you? Was Crossing the Line your brainchild, or is it something they brought to you and wanted to start it?
So Paper Ghost Season 1, the narrative podcast for iHeart, was really, I mean, it was number one for 4 or 5 weeks, and it continues to do really well. Season 2, Paper Ghosts, different case, same thing. Hit number one, and it's doing very well. So iHeart, we sat down, and they said, you know, we'd like to create some more with you. And I said, sure. You know, so I signed up for 2 more seasons of Paper Ghosts. I signed up for a separate narrative podcast that's not Paper Ghosts and not Crossing the Line. And then they said, we want to do a weekly with you. What do you have for an idea? So I gave them a pitch of what I wanted to do, and they said, great, we love it. Let's do it. So it kind of all came together because it's a great partnership, iHeart and I. We're a great partnership. They're a phenomenal company to work with in this space for me. My producer for Paper Ghosts, Christina Everett, godsend. I mean, I don't know how I could have done any of it without her. And she's on the weekly. She didn't want to do it. I said, but you're a natural talent. We have natural chemistry. We fight, you know, we disagree on stuff, and it's perfect. You're going to be my right hand person on the show. And she's great. She sounds great.
That's all. So tell us about Crossing the Line. If people tune in, what can they expect to hear on Crossing the Line?
So Crossing the Line, our third episode drops tomorrow. And what it is, you know, I'm taking all my experience from the true crime space, book writing, television, and more than anything, connections and access that I've managed to get over the years. You know, I know personally detectives everywhere, right? People trust me. I've never burnt a source, and so I get tremendous access to cases. And so with Crossing the Line, I'm going to do. It's going to be part missing people, you know, part a serial murder, part straightforward murder cases like Crime Junkies, like that. You know, I pick a case and we look at it. But I'm going to bring my experience and my expertise into it to kind of analyze different aspects of it and approach it in a different way. And you're going to hear interviews with experts as well. You know, like last week's episode was the Annie Lay case from Yale. She was murdered at Yale, a scientist. And I just happened to know the crime scene tech who found her inside of a wall, Peter Valentin. And so I said, Peter, come on the show. Let's talk about it. So, you know, Annie Lay was a big high profile case when it happened, but now I'm bringing in somebody who was there to tell a story that has never been told about it. And that's what I'm going to do with Crossing the Line. You might be familiar with the case, but you're not going to be familiar with the information I'm going to give you with guests and my own experience.
Right. Yeah. And you interview victims, family members, like you said, people who worked on the case, experts.
And one of my big things that I want to promote with this, that I want to project out, is victims' families' stories of what they go through, right? Of the process of, especially when we're talking about missing people and unsolved cases. You know, every knock on the door, every time a phone rings, could be 20, 30 years, a family wonders. Is that the call? Is that the knock? So I want to bring family members on, and I want them to just talk and say what they need to say. I just interviewed a family 2 days ago. It's going to be an episode coming up in a couple of weeks. And this family, a minority woman's son went missing, and the cops wouldn't help her. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't help her. And so she had to do it herself. She ends up finding her own son dead in a river. The mother is the one who finds the son. So those are the types of stories I want to bring, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously I'm going to be talking. There's a part of the show, Crossing the Line, the first 5 minutes or so, where I'm going to talk about a topical issue, Gabby Petito right now, whatever. But I'm not going to be focusing on that high profile stuff for the most part. I'll talk about it. I'll give my opinion on it, and then I'll move on to my case for the week. But I just think the way that high profile cases are made, created, I just have a problem with it. Mm-hmm. I just have a problem with it. There's missing people. There's families hurting everywhere, and you know. And look, I called this back in 2017. I wrote about it in a book. I called it then the Natalie Holloway syndrome. Mm-hmm. Now it's called the white woman syndrome. But in 2017, I wrote about it. I said, you know, if a blonde, blue-eyed girl from a wealthy family or a suburban family goes missing, the satellite trucks are at the house. But
right.
You know, down the street, there's a Latino family, there's a Puerto Rican family, there's a black family, and they have a person missing, and there's no one talking to them.
Right.
And that's wrong. And that is wrong. That is wrong. But that's, I think, that's who we are as a country, really. Right? It's like, those are the stories that get the ratings. Those are the, so the media jumps at that opportunity, you know? Not to say that Gabby Petito is not important. Of course, she's a daughter, you know? She's a sister, whatever. And her life is as valuable as somebody else's, but we can't place more value on one life than another. You follow me, Bob?
100%. You know, I just had this conversation a couple weeks ago on the show about Gabby Petito, discussing exactly what you're discussing. We looked at, you know, how many missing and murdered indigenous women are being ignored and all these things. And you know, the point I was making is along the same lines of what you're saying is, my point is not that Gabby Petito deserved less attention. My point is that everybody deserves that attention. That she it shouldn't only be the like you said, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed white girl that has the whole nation in an uproar looking for her. It's not that she deserves less, but we should have that same passion to help everyone.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You know, in 2011, I did a episode of my show Dark Minds called The Highway of Tears. And I traveled about 800 miles north of Anchorage, Alaska, into British Columbia, where the Highway of Tears kind of begins.
Mm-hmm.
And it travels all throughout Canada over towards Toronto, 3,000 miles. But I went up there and I interviewed Indigenous Native families because those were the women that were missing up there.
Right.
And they were like, nobody cares. No, nobody cares. Nobody's looking for my daughter. Nobody cares. And I left that area with a cloud over me, you know, that one day I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to, I'm going to focus on it. And it's just heartbreaking because, you know, from my own family, there's an unsolved murder in my family. My brother's wife was strangled to death. She was 5 months pregnant in 1996. Yeah. And so I know what it's like for a family. I can empathize with a family going through the same thing, you know, and it's, I look at their kids. My brother's dead as well now. And I look at their kids, and there's just this hollowness about them, you know, that somebody killed our mother. It's unsolved. And she was not well liked by the police, their mother. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, man. I don't know. And that's why I'm crossing the line. I'm doing this episode about this mother who found her own son. That's why I'm doing
right.
it. I'm doing it to give them a fucking voice that they fucking deserve. That's why I'm doing it.
And I think that's also the whole concept of taking these cases, and not the big popular high profile cases, but shining a light on lesser known cases. And that leads, I want to talk a couple things. One, we've said a couple times things that happened like this week or last week. So Matthew and I are recording this probably about 4 weeks before it airs. And in those, so the episode you're talking about with the mother who found her own son should be already on the air by the time our audience hears this. So definitely check that out. And I believe the case that we're going to touch on right now, it hasn't aired yet, but it's the case of Patty. Is it Lucy or Luce? How do you pronounce her last name?
Patty Luce.
Patty Luce. This is another episode that's coming that should have aired already when this episode airs. For you to check it out. But why don't you give us kind of the basic beats of the Patty Luce case?
Patty Luce case is, I grew up in the same town, Vernon, Rockville, Connecticut. And I have to go back to Paper Ghost season one. That is about four missing girls from my hometown of Vernon, Rockville. And that I grew up, you know, I grew up hearing about, I knew one of the girls, etc. And when, you know, lots of people over the years, because I had been investigating those cases for 12 years at the time. And over the years, I would get people writing to me about, you know, Patty Luce, you should include her in these four girls. Cause you know, and she was never connected to the four girls. And I, you know, but it was a case, Patty Luce, that everybody knew about. You know, I went to school with one of her brothers. You know, she was a bit older than me, so she was out of high school by the time I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Or she was in high school, I wasn't in high school yet, rather. So Patty Luce, her parents are on vacation in New Hampshire. She's home with her brothers. She's 17, 18 years old. And her brother drives her to the 7-Eleven nearby at night. And, you know, it's a frequent place. I frequented it myself. You loiter there, you hang out, you drink beers in the car, you smoke on the side of the building. You know, it's right near the high school. So back then, and this is 78, back then, this was a place that you would definitely hang out at. In the 80s, sure. So she's never seen again after that. So she goes into the store. The brother says, you know, do you want to ride home? And she's like, no, I'll walk, because it's very close to the house, very close. And we walked everywhere then. We walked everywhere. So the brother takes off. He goes, you know, out on his bike. And Patty walks out of the 7-Eleven, and she's not seen again for like 8 months. And then her body's found like 40 miles away. And it's an unsolved case, but on the show that you'll hear, the episode, I solved this case. I know who did it.
Oh, wow.
I spent a lot of years on this case. I interview her brother, who's never been interviewed, not for a show, but by police. He was interviewed that night, the next day, but he hasn't been re-interviewed since. I interview him. I interview her other brother and her father. We talk about what happened. We talk about the dynamic of the neighborhood. We talk about who was at the 7-Eleven that night. I was able to get some exclusive reports from the Vernon Police Department about the case. And so you're going to hear from her sister. You're going to hear from her brothers and her father. And you're going to hear who did this. You're going to hear who did this and what happened to Patty Luce.
Well, that's awesome. I can't wait for that episode to air. And I think your producers told me that it's going to air in about 3 weeks from now. It should be. So for you guys listening to this right now, if you haven't already, that's one to check out. Matthew and his team are, well, is your team is you, right? You're the, I mean, you have a team for the production of the podcast, but you're the one that's out doing the investigative work and all that.
Yeah, I do the investigative work. I'm kind of mentoring Christina Everett, my producer, cohort extraordinaire on Crossing the Line. You know, but there's only so much she can do. But I, you know, I have the contacts. I work it. You know, I get the documents. I'm a big document guy. I like to look at documents from the time a crime occurred, and I like to use those documents as a roadmap to start questioning people, you know, talking to people, interviewing people. The people, you know, people know what happened, but sometimes they don't know that they know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes all it takes is for someone to come in. I call it like crime hindsight. You know, a case is kind of sitting there, and then someone new comes in and looks at it objectively, not from the lens of all the cops who looked at it, because, you know, it's hard when you're in it. You're too close to it. I look at it and I notice things. I notice new things, you know. You know, and I'm stealthy sometimes when I do some work, when I question, when I interview people. Uh-huh. They don't know they're being interviewed, you know. They don't know who I am, you know. I kind of just bump into them, you know.
Right.
So it takes what it takes, you know. That whole, if you know something, say something. Well, what happens in cold cases is, and you might have heard this before, but time changes a lot, because maybe the police interviewed somebody and then 10 years go by and that person now is divorced from their husband, or they had a fallout with these people and now they want to start dishing. They want to start talking about what they know. There's no ties anymore to that those people. So it's very important to keep re-interviewing people over a span of time.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I have a case I'm working right now on Truth and Justice. Was time changes things in so many different ways. In this case, you had a victim that wouldn't name, it was a wrongful conviction case, wouldn't name the people that had attacked him and shot him and killed his friend.
Wow.
And, you know, years later, you know, 15 years later, now he's like, he's naming names. And in an interview, he said, look, I was an idiot. I was a thug. I wanted to take care of it myself. I didn't want the police getting in the way. And now I'm a grown man. I'm mature. And
that's how it works.
Yeah. So time definitely changes things. Well, I can't wait to hear that episode when it comes out. His name is M. William Phelps. The podcast is called Crossing the Line. Check it out. There'll already be about 7 or 8 episodes in by the time you hear this episode. Give it a listen. I'm sure it's going to be your next big true crime binge. And Matthew, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today. Really looking forward to hearing the rest of the podcast.
It was great to meet you, Bob. Great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
True Crime Binge is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Audioboom. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing. Music and artwork by Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com. Our website, TrueCrimeBinge.com, was created by Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com. If you're a listener and would like to recommend a future guest or a podcaster that would like to request an interview, you can do so right on our website. And again, that web address is TrueCrimeBinge.com. If you're enjoying the show, please do me a huge favor and take a minute to rate and review us on iTunes or whatever platform you're using to listen. And make sure you give us a follow on social media. We can be found everywhere at True Crime Binge. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure you tune in next Wednesday morning for another podcaster, another case, and another True Crime Binge.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.